Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Alice McElroy about her psychological suspense novel, The Glass Woman. Alice is born in London and she graduated in English and has a postgraduate degree in law. She completed Faber Academy's novel writing programme and has taught in state schools in London and Milan. Her writing has been longlisted for the Stylist Prize for Feminist Fiction and the Grindstone International Novel Prize. In this episode, we discuss her world building in a novel where the technology is slightly more advanced than our own, writing about AI before it hit public consciousness and the impact that had on trying to sell her novel, and the challenge of switching between the private writer and the public author. But before that, here's Alice with an excerpt from The Glass Woman.
My name is Iris and I'm 35 years old. My husband is called Marcus. I was born in Suffolk, England. I work at the London Research Institute. It is Wednesday, the 1st of May. This is what I have just been told. Waking is like wading through deep water. I'm half within my body and half without. I look down at this body I inhabit. It is dressed in a crumpled blue cotton gown. Pain, which starts in my head with a drilling sensation, spreads. As my eyes adjust to the light, the room before me becomes clear. A single bed, a chair, a closed window. A tube attached to my hand wires me to a machine. The room is still, silent, save the machine's heartbeat. I hear a man's voice as he appears from the hallway. Iris. His voice sounds as though it comes from a great distance, above the water surface as I'm drowning below. In a swift movement, he sweeps a hand across his head. Iris? I open my mouth to speak, only no sound comes. Then a jumbled mix of consonants and vowels with no recognisable pattern escapes. My mind reels and twists, trying to form the words I want to say. I try again. He moves towards me and sits beside the bed. He edges the chair closer. He is tall, with dishevelled hair, sunken cheeks, amber eyes. Tentatively, he reaches his hand to my face, moving hair from my eyes. I grasp the mattress. It's me. A pause of several seconds. Marcus, your husband. My mind tremors, as though he has flicked a switch in my brain and my vision shifts. I have no recollection of him, or me, or anything that has come before this moment. I tell myself, don't panic, don't panic.
Hi Alice, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Glass Woman.
Thank you, Chloe. I'm incredibly excited to be here because I loved your debut, The Sea Woman, and I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. So kind of you. Can you start by telling us what The Glass Woman is about?
Yes. So it's a cautionary tale about an AI brain implant, and it's a psychological thriller. When scientist Iris wakes in hospital with no memories, she's told that she volunteered to trial a pioneering AI brain implant. But is she a victim of AI or a scientist playing God? Iris is an unreliable narrator in that she wakes with amnesia. She has no recollection of who she is. And consequently, the reader meets her at her most vulnerable and goes on a journey with her as she begins to reconstruct her identity and discover her past. It has some similar themes to Frankenstein in exploring kind of unorthodox experiments and our responsibility for our creations. And I think it's quite a contentious topic, and it's likely to spark some differing views and debate.
I thought it was such a smart thriller and really well written, but also it felt like, because it's slightly sci-fi, but not in a way that feels completely far removed from what we're seeing at the moment. And this, obviously, you've landed your book at the sweet spot, because AI is everywhere at the moment. So it's like the perfect book for this time. But I'm wondering, obviously, you wrote this book quite a few years ago, and how did you get to the point where you were kind of writing about AI? I'm guessing kind of 3, 4, 5 years ago. Where did that kind of early inspiration come from?
Well, I started writing it from a place of fear. I was writing about what frightened me, and the potential for AI and the ethical implications particularly really frightened me. And it was at a time when surveillance technology was gaining prominence as well. And so that those two things combined in the concepts of Glass Woman. And I began asking kind of, if a character had AI implanted into their brain, what could they trust of the information being fed to them? Where would control and consent begin and end? And could the human mind cope with that? Yeah, it was really writing about the things that frightened me that drove the idea for the novel. And my message about AI or technology isn't that it's bad, it isn't that the technology is bad, but that we need to give serious kind of thought and care as to how it's used. And there were a lot of, there was a political theorist called Langdon Winner, who was quite an inspiration as well, who was writing in the 1970s about the correlation between our relationship with technology and Frankenstein's kind of flight from responsibility when confronted by his own creation. So that idea about kind of giving thought and care to AI within human relationships was important as well.
Yeah, it's also the human element of, it's not necessarily the technology that's the frightening part, it's the person in control of the technology that's the frightening aspect.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there's so much AI around at the moment, but I'm wondering kind of what research you had to do to make this feel really believable and real. And I can't imagine how difficult it must have been, because obviously the technology side of it moves so quickly that you're always probably feeling like you're trying to catch up on yourself when you're researching these things.
Definitely, there's things emerging every day in terms of AI. So it's progressing so quickly. Even when I started writing it in 2017, there were precedents in terms of brain implants. There was a neurologist called Phil Kennedy who in 2014, I think it was, traveled to Belize to avoid FDA regulation and experimented on his own brain. And yeah, had an implant implanted that he later removed kind of less than a year later. But there were already precedents. But it, yeah, I mean, when I started writing it in 2017, Neuralink had announced its intention to kind of experiment, connect human brains to computers. And then by the time my novel was published in January 2024, they've already started their first kind of human patient experiment. So the speed at which it's changed and progressed is unbelievable. I did a lot of research into kind of the technology, but paired a lot of it back in the novel to make it more commercial and less kind of sci-fi. And I also did a lot of research into the ethics, and there was a particular AI researcher, Dr. Mike Seymour, who I was very indebted to for kind of reading a draft of it and conversations with him, which were very influential.
Brilliant. I wondered, when it comes to kind of that world building element, you mentioned making your technology kind of more commercial, more accessible for the reader to understand, but I'm wondering about the kind of world in general, because it is our world. We're not talking kind of spaceships or that far ahead in the future, but there are elements of it that are kind of technology that's familiar to us, but slightly different or slightly more advanced. How did you go about kind of deciding what aspects of the world were going to be futurized and what were going to be kind of familiar to us?
So I did want it to be speculative and kind of our world, but slightly strange and advanced. And my editor Gemma Creffield was really helpful with that, and she suggested paring it back even more in terms of just having one aspect of technology that's advanced, and the AI brain implant Ariel, and everything else being kind of recognisably our world. And in that sense, it's quite like Black Mirror, I think, where it is
Definitely.
a very close future. And in kind of the final drafts of it, I actually pared the world building back more to make it really focus on kind of the domestic sphere and the psychological. So it's not actually that much that remains in the book about kind of the outside world, world building, because yeah, the focus is so much on domestic.
It kind of reminds me, now you've mentioned Black Mirror, and I cannot remember what the episode is called. It's one of the very early ones where there was a device to rewind memory and kind of study the same event that a couple had. I think it was like an argument they'd had or something. And I think, if I'm right, the woman was having an affair with someone else, and the husband kept like rewinding the footage and of his own brain. And the kind of that kind of domestic tension really reminds me of your novel, actually.
Yes, I have seen that episode. That's a brilliant episode.
Yeah, it
Yeah, that idea of like different perceptions of the same event and
is.
technology being used to almost kind of,
Yeah,
yeah, judge.
I can definitely see the links there between that episode and your novel. And I think anyone that enjoys Black Mirror and that kind of believable sense of the future would really enjoy, particularly as well if you like a good thriller. Yours does that job really well with that nice added kind of slice of what if.
Thank you.
And obviously memory plays such a key role. When Iris wakes up, she can't really remember much apart from what she's been told. And that's such a terrifying prospect itself as well, to be in this environment where she's on her own, there's just all these glass walls everywhere. Were you thinking about, because obviously this is a thriller, were you thinking about kind of the things that would frighten a reader and kind of make them on edge as they were reading when you were kind of planning and deciding what to include in this novel?
I think I was thinking about what would unnerve me in like how vulnerable we are without our memories, especially if you were to wake up without a support network around you. So that definitely played into it. I didn't want to unnerve the reader as such, but I was thinking about what would make it tense and uncomfortable. And I also, so my grandma was an art historian, and she used to say that artists should confront uncomfortable questions. So I guess there's also an aspect of wanting to kind of confront uncomfortable questions in my writing. And yeah, I was also going through some quite dark times myself, personally and professionally, and a lot of that darkness pervades the book, and I got quite ill whilst I was writing it. So there's an aspect of writing as therapy as well. And the kind of fallibility of human memory does fascinate me. So that's definitely part of the inspiration for the book as well.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we obviously spend this novel completely in Iris's head, and you've mentioned, she's quite an unreliable narrator because she doesn't remember what the situation is, particularly in, let's say, particularly in her marriage. There's a lot of tension there. Did you always want to write as in a first person perspective and kind of keep it completely in her head, or did you experiment with maybe third person or looking at it from different perspectives?
So Iris's voice was always first person, and that was kind of the first voice that I wrote. But the first draft of the book had three points of view. It had her husband Marcus's point of view, a second person, and her lover Gabriel's as third person. And they were bigger characters in that sense. And it was more about kind of different perception of the same thing. But I realized that to make the novel work, it needed the claustrophobia of being in Iris's head. So I stripped out those two male voices, and consequently, they're more kind of nebulous as characters. You're not quite sure if you what you can trust about them because it's all Iris's perspective. And it also becomes more about the nature of perception, I think, in terms of what can be trusted and what can't. Iris doesn't even know the veracity of her own memories, so there's Yeah, it adds another layer of kind of unreliability to it, I think.
Obviously, with a novel like yours, you're deliberately holding back things from the reader, which is delightful when, as a reader, you're just, itching to find out all these reveals. Was that a challenge to kind of decide like what to reveal when? Were you like a kind of eager reader thinking, oh, I want to, reveal this secret now, but I've got to wait till page 254 or something?
That was a huge challenge for me, I think, because it was my first novel, because it was quite an ambitious concept in the sense of writing someone who doesn't even know who they are and they're constructing their identity on the page. And it took me a lot of drafts to get the reveals right. And at one point, I rewrote it from scratch from a quarter of the way through. And yeah, definitely in later drafts as well, I was still getting that the kind of layers of clues and reveals, right? Because it took a lot of plotting.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that actually, because, and people have probably heard me say this 100 times, but I always have this belief that crime writers, psychological thriller writers, all of that side of the fiction writing, in my head, you're all like perfect planners. You have your spreadsheets, you have your post-it notes, you have your charts with, wall writing them, all these things that help you plan a novel. But then a lot of writers say, no, I don't plan anything. So what's your kind of practical writing routine?
I think I've learned the need for planning. When I started this novel, I had the inciting incident, kind of the opening chapter, and I didn't know where it was going. And I kind of built the world and concept from there. But certainly in later drafts, I realized the importance of plotting it meticulously. Because I think, as you say, particularly for this genre, it is so much about those reveals, and it needs to be really tight in terms of plotting. But I try and do a mixture of the two because I think it is important to have space for it to kind of organically evolve as you get to know characters. So yeah, I try to balance the two, but I have learned to plot much more thoroughly.
And I'm interested just to know what you kind of do in terms of plotting. Do you have spreadsheets? Do you create little charts, or is it just kind of notes that you write, or do you follow any particular books or guides to help you plot things?
I've tried lots of different methods. For this book, I at one point had kind of post-it notes around my room that I'd move around as the order of events changed. And that was quite a helpful visual tool. But I tend to plot either in kind of bullet point form or on a grid with I found John Truby's, what is it called? I think it's Anatomy of a Story, very helpful to go back to. But yeah, I do actually have quite extensive plot documents that are sometimes kind of 10, 20 pages long with notes.
When I wrote The Sea Women, I always had the end in mind, so I knew what I was working towards, and I always think that's helpful because At least you know what you're aiming for then, rather than just kind
Yeah.
of, fumbling in the dark, not knowing what's next, which is, I think, how a lot of people write, to be fair. So,
I did that with my second. I have drafted my second novel and I planned
okay.
it really thoroughly beforehand. And it was really helpful just because I knew what the character motivation was at each point. And that was so helpful for not
Yeah.
wasting time going down a huge tangent.
I think perhaps if you're someone who has really figured out who your characters are, you might be okay to have no plan and just kind
Yeah.
of, feel your way through it. But I don't know. I think probably good stories probably have more planning than we realize, really. It's so under the surface, you don't really see it.
Yes.
I think that's the trick to it.
Yeah.
What for you is your kind of most challenging aspect of writing a novel?
I think planning probably is my most challenging part because in my everyday life, naturally, I'm not a planner.
Right,
So I
okay.
have to kind of force myself to sit
This
down
is
and do it.
baffling for me, Alice, because you're a teacher, okay, and
I
I've been a teacher, and I, to begin with, in my well, particularly at the beginning of my career, my plans, my lesson plans were like, I rigid that I clung to
Yeah.
like a life raft, thinking, please save me. But I guess you've been teaching now for long enough, you don't need them.
My lesson plans were the same at the beginning. I planned to a ridiculous level everything. But yeah, I don't in the same way now. But I have to force myself to plan because I know it will help me rather than it being natural.
I'm interested to kind of rewind time really and talk about your interest in writing and whether you've been writing for a long time. Have you tried to write a novel before this, or is this your first stab at it?
This was my first stab. So I'd written short stories before and poems terribly, terrible poems. But I did English at university and I loved the creative writing modules I did. I always knew I wanted to write, but it just felt really aspirational and kind of out of reach, and like I needed to get life experience first. So I went into working in a number of different jobs, taught for a long time, and then when I was working in quite a difficult environment, I started writing more as therapy, and then I enrolled on the Faber Academy course, which I know you've done too, and it was transformational. Sarah May, my course tutor, is amazing, really inspirational, and my writing group from Faber still meet every week, and we're meeting tonight to discuss my third book, which is very
Oh
exciting.
wow, that's exciting.
So that kind of support network and that community is so valuable as a writer, I find.
So what made you take the leap and do Faber then? Because I think that's obviously quite a commitment, and it's quite a serious intention, I think, to do a
Yeah.
course like that, which is A, is incredibly expensive, and B, has the
Yeah.
reputation of, it does help people to bridge that gap between, writing as a hobby and, as like you say, aspiration, to writing as a serious business and career.
Yeah.
And I mean, I did an MA, but it wasn't until Faber that I was like, oh, okay, there is a way to get an agent and a book deal and all the rest. And Faber was the reason that happened for me. So what
Yeah.
point did you sort of think, I'm gonna give this writing lark a go?
I'd been wanting to write seriously for the whole of my 20s, and it was I can't remember how old I was, kind of late 20s, mid to late 20s, that I was just in a place kind of personally and professionally where I knew it was now or never. And so I embarked on it. And I did think about kind of MA or Faber course. And because I was working, it seemed more doable to do a Faber course rather than a university master's. But as you say, it was so useful. It was so practical in terms of getting into the industry. And like you, thanks to the anthology that led me to my agent. So, and yeah, I saw myself as a writer for the first time. So I'd highly recommend it. But it is, as you say, an investment. It's, yeah.
I would stress as well that I know I speak to a lot of people that have done MAs or Faber or Curtis Brown, and you really don't need these courses to be published. But they are an amazing way to not just learn things, but to build a community and to have those people in your life that understand the pain of being a writer and of stupid questions where you're like, should this be third person or present tense or all these questions that normal people in your life will look at you like, who cares? But tell us a little bit about your book deal, because it's so interesting that you got this book deal before we really had heard of AI, I suppose, or knew what it could. And now, I mean, God, now you can't move for people talking about AI. So tell us a little bit about how the kind of book deal came about.
So my book was being sent to publishers 2 years ago, and that was before AI had kind of entered public consciousness. So for me, it's a lesson in actually not writing to trends because of the way the publishing industry works, I
Basically,
think.
you predicted the future, is what you're trying to say.
Exactly. No, it's very, very lucky. The timing is actually quite unbelievable. Like, I knew that it was going to be topical, but there was no way of knowing how topical it would be. But also, as I said, I was writing from a place of fear. So I was writing about things, the rate of progress frightens me. So I'm like, I'm as concerned as the next person is. So it was from a point of view of feeling like we need to talk about it and trying to spark debate. But to answer your question about my publisher, so my publisher Datura, which is a new imprint of Angry Robot Books, they kind of saw the potential in May 2022 and took a risk on it. And for that, I'm hugely grateful. And it was being pitched at a time when it wasn't topical. So it just shows how quickly, I guess, because the publishing industry works quite slowly with kind of 2 year lead-ins or 18-month lead-ins between a book being bought and publication. By the time your book's published, the kind of public debate and conversation could have moved on so much.
Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the exact right time for the book to come out. And I just said to you before we start recording, in about 18 months' time, we're not going to be able to move for books about AI. So you've started the trend, really. You've kind of hit, you've covered all bases. I mean, there doesn't really need to be any AI books now, frankly, because you've done it and you've done it well. So I
Thanks,
think,
Chloe.
yeah, but I couldn't think of a better time to. It's kind of fortunate that it landed when it did, really.
The timing is crazy because just weeks after it was published, Neuralink was announcing it had done its first human patient trial on its brain implant. So yeah, it just couldn't
It
have predicted.
stops becoming speculative now. It starts
Exactly,
becoming
it's frightening.
just contemporary fiction, basically. You were also long listed for the Stylist Prize for Feminist Fiction, which is fantastic. And I wondered whether that kind of gave you a lift in the sense of confirming that this book had potential, because I think sometimes it's hard to know whether what you're writing is something is good, is worth going out there into the world. But did it help give you that confidence?
Definitely. That was a huge boost. And that actually happened when I was gearing up to submit my novel to publishers. So that happened. And I also got longlisted for the Grindstone International Novel Prize. So yeah, it was incredible. And there's been a couple of moments like that. I also had in January a mention, a review in The Guardian as one of the best recent sci-fi books.
Wow,
So
fantastic. Congratulations. And I
thanks.
mean, and also that's even more of an achievement because your novel is published by an independent, so it's not like you're necessarily going to get the same attention from press as you would if you were published by like the Big Five. So that's even more of an achievement.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Well done.
Yeah, it's, I guess also with, you don't know how readers will respond to it out there. So
Yeah,
that was a huge moment.
definitely. So For any writer who's about to go through the brilliant yet terrifying process of having their first book published, I wondered what your tips or advice would be for coping with the kind of 18 months of weirdness between signing your contract and the book being out there in the world. How would you cope as, or how did you cope as a debut novelist?
My main piece of advice would be to try and finish, or begin at least, but try and finish a second book before your first one's published, because I personally found the exposure around publication so overwhelming that it was some reassurance and kind of took some of the pressure off to finish a draft of it. I listened to Jenny Godfrey's interview that you had with her a couple of weeks ago. And she mentioned that she finds publicizing a book takes a very different part of her character to writing. And I'd really agree with that, in that I struggle to switch between the two. So finishing a draft of a second book before the first one's published definitely helps. I personally am just trying to write something every day. I know Jenny mentioned that as well. And just try and stay in the flow of it, and sometimes I write 2,000 words, sometimes I write hardly anything at all, but just finding ways to kind of juggle the publicity with sitting down and kind of deep dive into writing a novel.
It, like you say, it's that kind of public versus private, and being perhaps more extroverted than you're necessarily comfortable with,
Yes.
to promote your book, and then suddenly go back and hide and squirrel away and write all your nice words, basically. Jenny tried to get me to write every day, and she said, "We can just write 30 words." And I was like, "No." She said, "We can just write 2 words." I was like, "No, I'm not doing it." Just because I was feeling like I didn't fancy doing it that day. And I know a writing habit is good for you, but she wasn't getting any words out of me that day. So, but yeah, you're right. You're right. Writing something every day, or every day you can manage is the way forward, I think. So I'm really eager now, Alice, to hear what's next. I know you mentioned book three, but I also want to hear about book two. So give us a little tease about them both, please. I want to hear it.
So my second novel's very different to The Glass Woman. It's similarly speculative, but whereas The Glass Woman's more kind of domestic, claustrophobic, my second novel's more macro in scope and looking at kind of legacy, our legacy, what we leave behind, and also secrets surfacing in a religious community. And I was interested in reading The Sea Women from that point of view.
I was about to say that sounds like very up my street,
Yeah.
so yeah.
And then my third novel I've just started sketching out, and that's more similar in style to The Glass Woman. So
Oh,
we'll see.
fantastic.
Yeah.
They both sound brilliant, and I'm such a fan of speculative novels, probably for the same reason you are, in that they scare me but also just fascinate me as well at the same
Yeah.
time. It's like a when you're writing them, you have the control of the fear, don't you? So you don't have to, you can't scare yourself too much, but it's still enjoyable to think, what if I push this button? How frightened am I going to be? But yeah, I love that kind of speculative stuff, and I think, like I said earlier, I think your novel's really going to appeal to kind of Black Mirror fans and people who'd like just like a good thriller, but with believable kind of technology aspect to it as well. And so excited to see what's coming next for you, Alice. But good luck with The Glass Women, and thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Chloe. It's been a huge honour and really, really lovely speaking to you.
That was Alice McElroy talking about her psychological suspense novel, The Glass Woman, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors, and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.